Shumrabyug.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Shulook. Shulisten, the podcast that takes a pop at culture.
Shulook, Shulisten.
Shulook, Shulisten.
Shulook, Shulisten.
Shulook, Shulisten.
Shulook,
Shulisten.
Shulook, Shulisten.
Shulook, Shulisten.
Oh, very good. And very exciting. Welcome to Shulook Shulisten, Ireland's leading. No, you know what, Benjamin? I'm going to confidently say it. The world's leading Michelle Pfeiffer and X-Men 97 fan cast. But Shulook, we don't have time to analyse and interrogate that statement because there's loads of stuff going on, including, shockingly, a controversy on the internet. And we've seen trailers for Dark Matter and Dead Boy Detectives and Joker Fully Adieu. Further to that, to nobody's surprise, Benjamin, I've seen Fallout, which is quite good, but we're going to review it, but not really spoilers. And then we're going to spoil the heck out of X-Men 97 Episode 5.
Sure, listen, Michael. If you're worried that's not enough for a weekly pop culture podcast, have a kind of angst, Michael, because we're also going to be taking a look at 1985's Fucking Lady Hawk.
Fucking Lady Hawk. Now, Benjamin, I watched the film Lady Hawk. If you watch the film Fucking Lady Hawk, this might be why we have different opinions on it.
I was really wondering why you said, "Ah, it's grand. You can watch it with anyone in the room." You can't, Michael.
No, you watch Fucking Lady Hawk. That's a different film. But Benjamin, speaking of fucking ladies, I'll tell you where we don't want them in our pop culture.
That was very good. That was very good. I like that.
Thank you very much. Good. I've done the thing.
Yeah, Michael, so we got a story there yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Big news.
This is fresh, Michael. This is hot take on the pulse of pop culture here, Michael.
Hot take incoming, Ben. Hot take incoming.
Now, Michael, there is no greater community striving for equality and an egalitarian society than Warhammer and Warhammer 40K. They love women over there.
Now, I'm going to stop you straight away. Because I'm going to disrupt your little narrative that you have going on here. Because Ben, without putting a spin on it, just tell us what happened first of all.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. There was a leak, Michael, because we're getting an updated codex for the Adeptus Custodes. We're getting the 10th edition later this month.
Of Warhammer. This is Warhammer 40,000, by the way.
Of Warhammer 40,000. Grand bunch of lads. Not the characters in that universe. Big old bloody fascists, but
Ben, I have so much to say about this because Warhammer is one of my big things, and I have a lot to say about this. So I'm going to urge you to get on with it a little bit, because otherwise we're going to spend 40 minutes talking about this.
All right, Jesus! Well, don't shit on my hobby, Ben. Oh, don't.
No, you can shit on it all you want because I'm going to shit on it. I'm definitely going to shit on it.
All right.
But there's a lot to say about this, and one of look, you're not playing ball with me. So one of the things I'm going to say is, one of the interesting things, and this is a complicated issue that is very easily boiled down into us versus them, and that is a wrong and bad take. But one of the very complicated issues in this story is in recent years, and I'm not assigning a value judgment to this, in the last few years, Warhammer, the universe of Warhammer, has gotten much less worse. And it's gotten much clearer goodies and baddies. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s, when Warhammer was invented, Space Marines and Imperial Guard and the Human Empire and all of that was a Paul Verhoeven, Starship Troopers-esque, Rogue Trader-esque, Judge Dredd-esque satire of Thatcher's Britain.
Yeah.
And they were the fucking worst. And they were the baddies, and they were based on space fascists. And in the 80s, people could enjoy satire and understand that it was satire. And satire was much more obvious and on the nose. And one of the things that's happened over the last few years with Warhammer is they're making cleaner, nicer, more clearly good guy characters.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons that this thing that's happened is able to happen.
Okay. I like that, Michael. But That was good. I like that. Anyway, Michael, within this updated Adeptus Custodes, is it a codex? I think it's a codex.
I don't know if they still call them codexes because it's going to be defunct in about 3 months, so I don't buy them anymore.
All right, okay, fair enough. Anyway, in this, Michael, there's a short story, a narrative hook, as is often included in these things, to help players get a sense of the je ne sais quoi of the world they're about to dive into. In this, there's a story around female custodian guard. Thank you. Michael's going to have to correct me quite a bit on this one. We're introduced to, and I could get this wrong, Calidus Toravaliakesh.
Who fucking knows, Ben? That's made up.
Calidus Toravaliakesh. Toravaliakesh, which is very hard to say.
Yeah, this is a great podcast. I'd listen to a podcast of just you mangling that name for an hour.
Yeah, she's engaging in a blood game, which is something the custodians regularly do to test the security around the Emperor. Because the Adeptus Custodes, their sole job, Michael, they're known as the 10,000, isn't it?
Benjamin, their sole job used to be to guard the Emperor. But then, you know what happened?
What happened?
Games Workshop said, if there's these lads and they're super special and they are akin to, they are to a Space Marine what a Space Marine is to Ben Colopy, then it's such a shame that they never leave the Emperor's palace on Earth, because we can't justify putting them in the game and selling a load of models. So
yeah, because they never leave Earth.
Because they never leave Earth. They never leave the Emperor's palace. They never leave his side. So then they said, ah, fuck that. Now, they're always out and about. And there's loads of them. Don't worry about it. Do you want to buy these models?
Yeah, a classic case of capitalism gone wrong, Michael, where they've taken all the mystery and joy out of one of the Imperium's greatest kind of mysterious figures, the custodians, the big bad in the dark, or the big golden bad in the dark, and they've just gone, nah.
Here they are now. They were here the whole time. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. So anyway, we're introduced to this woman, Michael, and it's caused waves within the fandom, with a clear delineation between people crying woke and other people have been like, actually, I think it's grand if we introduce women to the custodians. I don't think it's an issue at all, actually.
No, I disagree with that completely, Ben. First of all, there isn't a clear delineation. There's definitely a middle ground. But one of the most divisive things about this incident is that either side of it paints anybody who doesn't 100% agree with them as the woke end of it has gone immediately to, there's a certain subsection of Warhammer fans that are incel, neckbeard, misogynist, racist bigots. And at the same time, which is what you've decided has happened. And at the same time, there's people who, there probably are some people who like Warhammer and hate women. There probably are. But at the same time, there's some people who've gone, yeah, they've made a change there to some lore that I really love and I don't really like it. And to tar everyone with that opinion as a sexist, racist bigot is as far on the wrong side the other way as it is possible to go, and needlessly divisive.
But Michael, this year, we are actually changing the name of the podcast at the end of 2024 to Needlessly Divisive.
Needlessly divisive, doing it for the clicks. There's a battle happening on the internet between the two worst sides of this. There's the people who hate it because they hate women, and then there's the people who think anybody who even slightly doesn't like it is a racist, sexist, neckbeard incel. And both sides of that are just so wrong and awful. It's possible to not like the fact that there are female custodians because it's a change to the lore. And you can not like it and still get along with it.
Yeah, fair enough. I'll tell you who's rubbing their hands together, Michael.
Go on.
The bloody Rule 34ers and the fanfickers. Oh, they're rubbing those.
They're
together,
even worse.
Michael.
They're worse than everyone.
Why are they worse than everyone, Michael?
They're worse than, literally, they're worse than the literal Nazis in the fanbase, Ben. At least they're not making weird sex porn about custodians.
Very good. Very good, Michael. Anyway, we don't care one way or the other because we have other things to talk about. For example...
No, hold on. But this is very... Okay, we're done, are we?
No, we're not done. Go back. Michael, I didn't realise you had more to say. I'm sorry.
It's fascinating. This is a fascinating thing. This is the kind of content, Ben, that if we miss out on this now, we'll come back to in 10 years and say, wasn't that an incredible sociological moment? Because there's so much to learn from this about fandoms, about corporations, about changing demographics, enjoying a product, about changing your product to suit demographics. This could be a turning point in Warhammer where this is one of the first kind of things that they start doing that leads them down the Marvel/Star Wars fan base route of alienating their fan base.
Yeah, point in one direction or the other.
And it's, I think it's just as dangerous to roundly turn on anybody who doesn't like this and mock them and ridicule them and try to remove them from their hobby. Turning on your fans is just, I don't know if we've learned the lesson yet from mega corporations, but turning on and alienating the fans who love the thing the way it is to try to accommodate more people who might like it if you change it for them. It's a fascinating topic for discussion.
If the goal is purely money, if the goal is, let's say...
It always is.
Okay, let's break it down to its bare bones then. The aim is to sell more models and more books.
Yes, exactly.
Presumably by Dan Abnett. Or to open up the possibility of just wholesale launching a bunch of female characters in armor into the new Amazon Prime show from Henry Cavill.
For example. But even that then is to generate money. Because someone is saying, maybe if the custodies included girls, then we could sell more models to girls or people who want to see girls represented.
It's funny because at the same time, first of all, I think it's a bad move. If that's your goal, if your goal is to make money, you're correct. Alienating your fan base with this move is probably not the best move in the world. On the other hand, I don't think that this was a stunt by Games Workshop. I don't think it's a big announcement. I think there's a leak in a thing. Maybe they leaked it themselves. I don't know, Michael. I don't know.
They probably the other did. Thing, go on.
But the other thing is there's sisters in Warhammer. There's loads of armored women in Warhammer.
Look, it's fascinating. It's truly fascinating. It's a very interesting time to be a modern Games Workshop fan. Luckily for me, I'm really not. I haven't bought something directly from Games Workshop in years. So this really doesn't, this has nothing to do with me. I just think it's going to be a it's a fascinating study of the sociology of the battle between hardcore fans and newcomers to a thing. We've seen it in Marvel, we've seen it in Star Wars, we see it all the time across media. But I think, I was talking to my lovely wife about this the other day, Ben, because she was interested in this topic. This is going to be a fascinating battleground of cultural assumptions. It's very easy to assume that the inclusion of female characters in traditionally male-dominated armies is just naturally positive and progressive and good. And it's very easy to assume that anyone who doesn't agree with that is a horrible racist neckbeard. But also, if you dig into it a little deeper, maybe it's not good to have female representation in your literal space Nazis. Because then you're making them the good guys.
Who's to say, Michael? We'll have to check in about 5 years' time when this podcast is, of course, still going.
Still going, yeah.
Still not making money, Michael. Anyway, it is an interesting one. I think needlessly divisive might be the phrase of this conversation. If the leak was a mistake, fair enough. And it's just a story within a codex. I did watch one commentator, and I want to shout him out, and I'm going to get really annoyed with myself now if I can't remember who it is. But he mentioned a change in the lore is not necessarily a change in the hobby, as in to distinguish the lore of Warhammer 40K from the tabletop game that is incredibly popular. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but that's a whole other conversation then. There are plenty of people out there who are just fans of the lore.
Yeah.
There are plenty of people who don't play the game. They collect the armies, they paint the models, they watch the TV shows, they play the video games, and they've never rolled a dice in their life. There are people who are literally only fans of the lore. They don't buy the models, they buy the books. They like the universe. But the entire lore of this thing, the entire history of this game is full of incremental tiny changes. The Space Marines of 2024 are nothing like the Space Marines of 1993.
No.
Nothing. Other than they wear armor. They don't even wear the same armor. They don't even look the same.
Yeah. That was Tabletop Tom is where I got that opinion from, ladies and gentlemen, at the end. That's the name of him. Just in case anyone wants a little check on that. He had a nice breakdown of what was going on and how it came about. Tabletop Tom, gang.
Anyway, everyone just stop being horrible to each other and just get on with it.
Yeah. Michael, do you know, sometimes when we get covered in the morass of everyday fandoms tearing each other apart, do you know what I wish?
Do you wish that a handsome, competent version of yourself from another dimension would come into this dimension, drug you, kidnap you, and swap places with you.
Oh, Michael, I'd kill for it. It'd be great.
I've bad news, Ben. You're actually the worst Ben. There's no other Ben in all the multiverse who wants to come and take your spot. You're the only one who does this podcast. All the rest of them went, nah, you're all right.
All the rest of them are successful. And
yeah. All the rest of them are successful and don't have a podcast.
Wouldn't that be just apropos of nothing? We're going to talk about Dark Matter, the new show from Apple,
eventually.
In just a second. But can you imagine if you found out, if you're on a Rick and Morty style adventure or a Quantum Mania Loki moment, and you found out you are objectively the shittest one of your variants.
Yeah. You're the worst one. You're the absolute worst one. Funnily enough, I actually had a similar experience, but I found out I was Prime Mick. And that is also, in its own way, quite sad. I'm actually the only Mick who has a podcast.
So in this universe, Nadir Ben, and that's what I'm calling them if they're not Prime, and Prime Mick have found each other and made this fucking awful thing.
Yeah, exactly. It is a thing that has only happened. It's singular. This is a singularly bad situation where the best Mick, the best of a bad bunch, and the worst. Several of you, Ben, are presidents, but not this one.
Not this,
this one has a podcast.
Not this one.
Anyway, Ben, this is what's happened to Joel Edgerton.
Yeah, Joel Edgerton's having a tough old time in the upcoming April 23rd Dark Matter series from Apple TV. Sorry, I take that back. It's not April 23rd. That's Dead Boy Detectives, and I've mixed those up. Son of a bitch.
That's all right. Apple TV is the go-to place for cutting-edge science fiction. And by cutting-edge science fiction, stuff that happened 15 years ago. But this looks like a good one.
Yes, in the true Apple TV fashion, Michael, it's a good bit of hard speculative sci-fi.
Oh, and lovely.
No, but it's based on a book, as are all Apple TV things, and apparently one from 2016. It's a novel by a guy called Blake Crouch, and it's a novel of the same name. And it's about a former quantum mechanics physicist who is targeted by one of his own variants, as it were, to borrow a phrase from the Marvel Universe. He's targeted by one of his own variants and drugged and pulled out of his own reality, which is... Because originally, Michael, I watched it and I went, oh, I know what the twist is. He's going to have been kidnapped by himself. And then the show was just very, you fucking smug little shit. You smug
little
shit.
We're going to tell you
shit.
That anyway.
We're inverting it,
same,
you
Ben.
Fuck.
I was watching this going, this is fascinating. Something has happened. He's been drugged and he's woken up and everything is slightly different and he doesn't know why now. And then they just go, nah, it was your own clone, mate. Your grand.
Yeah, and they just full on say it.
They just solved the mystery in the trailer. The trailer on itself was its own little sci-fi journey.
Yeah, it was great. And then what I liked about it, Michael, is they got me back in because there's the reason that he's doing it isn't clearly given.
Yeah,
the reason
that I think it's just because the extra Bens, they just want a better opportunity.
They just want a better opportunity. Let me be married to Jennifer Connelly. Find me a universe where she's not hitched to one Paul Bethany.
Yeah, let me be married to Jennifer Connelly, not this other perfectly attractive woman. I'm totally against this.
Yes, not Michelle Braga, also equally attractive. Give me Jennifer Connelly or give me another reality. It looks to be very expensive, Michael, I thought.
It does. Apple are doing good stuff. Look, I hate to suckle at the teat of big corporations like this, Benjamin, but Apple are giving us what we want, sadly.
Yeah, if you want solid sci-fi, it's funny because it's Amazon Prime and Apple TV are like two sides of a terrible coin. They're both mega corporations, but one of them churns out awful drivel based on your favorite franchises with questionable special effects and big budgets. Amazon Prime, for example. The Rings of Power, not a great show.
Oh, The Rings of Power, okay. I watched Fallout, Ben, and that's on Amazon Prime. It's pretty good, so I didn't know what you were getting at there.
Fuck! You've ruined my analogy. Oh.
I've ruined your analogy, Ben. Your anal allergy. Ben, go on. Keep riffing.
No, I was
keep
just
riffing,
say,
Ben.
I'm going to step back and hope that another Ben takes me now.
There's no one vying for your spot, Ben. There's no one wants it. Sorry. I've got presidential stuff to do.
Anyway, this is coming out. It looks fun.
One of you actually lives in a weird menage a trois with Jennifer Connelly and Paul Bethany.
I mean,
that's a weird universe, though.
I can think of worse fates.
Hey, I won't get into the details. Ben, okay. Anyway, look, Speaking of dream alternate universes, there's a TV show coming out, or a movie maybe, which is basically your dream alternate universe. It's called Dead Boy Detectives.
Yeah, it's Dead Boy Detectives. Get out of town. Michael, if you're anybody on the Netflix these days, you'll probably have given the Sandman show from Netflix a go.
It was very good, wasn't it? Neil Gaiman did.
It was awfully good, Michael. Surprisingly good.
Probably cancelled.
Probably can't. Nah, probably not yet, Michael. It made them a lot of money, I think. I'm not sure. But anyway, Michael, they've bought the entire property because now, Michael, we're in the age of spin-offs. In good old-fashioned MCU kind of style, they've gone, oh, we've bought the whole property. Let's start churning these fuckers out.
Churn them out. What else can we do?
Churn them out. So we got a trailer a couple of weeks ago now for the Dead Boy Detectives, which is coming to us on April 23rd, Michael. And the Dead Boy Detectives are a detective duo of spooky ghosts who are on the run from death.
Sounds fabulous. Sounds like something you would come up with.
It does, actually. It's very much me. I had originally, Michael, had a quick pact for us to cross to the other side and become the dead co-hosts. That was going to be the name of this podcast.
Yeah, that's called a suicide pact, and I said no.
Yeah, and you said no, because you've got stuff to live for, because you're Mick Prime.
Mick Prime, I'm the best one. It's going better for me than any of the others. I think that's more tragic.
It possibly is. Anyway, Charles Rowland and Edwin Payne are the aforementioned Dead Boy Detectives, Michael, and they are older than me.
Oh, go on.
Because their debut came in The Sandman number 25 in April 1991.
Oh, older than you in a literary sense. Not the
in a
actors.
Literary sense. Yes, in a literary sense, Michael. Because way, way back in the day, when Neil Gaiman was in the middle of his Season of the Mists arc, where all the gods were vying for the key to hell, if you recall, in the Sandman comics, the Dead Boy Detectives made their appearance, and they're kind of Neil Gaiman's pastiche on The Famous Five, or Nancy Drew, or any kind of child detective series that would have been popular back in the day.
The Secret Seven.
The Secret Seven, Michael.
The Famous Five.
The Promiscuous Eight. Oh, no, sorry, that's a different thing again. Sorry, never mind.
That's the sequel.
That's a different thing, but anyway, we're getting this, Michael. Again, looks pretty good.
I don't know. Didn't catch my interest, I have to say.
It kind of got me in there, Michael. One of the main things that caught my interest is it's very much part of the Sandman universe because the character playing Death is the same woman from the Sandman show.
Get out of here. I don't think I even noticed.
Yeah, so it's definitely in that universe. I thought it had some nice horror elements to it, Michael. I thought that was looking very good. But the thing that I'm a little bit worried about, Michael, is that it looks like a riff on Lockwood & Co., which was the odd ghost hunting detective agency show that they had about a year ago now.
I think it was more. You recommended it to us, Ben, a few years back. I don't think anyone watched it, though.
I did, and nobody did, because it got cancelled, Michael. But this gave me very strong Lockwood & Co. vibes, and I was like, are you going to try this again, Netflix? Is that...
It's like any kind of ITV paranormal detective series about British boys from the 2000s to... It's that era, isn't it? It's the Torchwood era. I know Primeval is about adults hunting dinosaurs, but it gives
Same
me
thing.
That vibe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember that one about Van Helsing or whatever? What was that called?
Van Helsing, I think.
Was it not the one about the Lady Van Helsing, the English one about Van Helsing?
Oh, I don't remember that one. Oh, we'll have to go back and watch
that. I can't remember what it was called. It might have just been called Van Helsing.
Ah, oh, we'll have to go back and watch that. That'll be good.
No, it's rubbish.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Anyway, The Dead Boy Detectives, April 23rd. Who knows? It might be good. Who knows? I don't know.
Speaking of things that might be good, Benjamin, we also got a trailer for Joker.
Michael.
What is it?
Who in God's good green name decided...
That's not the phrase. Yeah, but go on.
It's very much not. But who decided that we needed Joker 2, Folie à Deux?
Benjamin, look, you might as well call me an Egyptian crocodile, because for the last 2 years, I've been swimming in denial about this being real. But... it must be real, because there's a trailer now, and we've seen it, and it appears to be very much real.
Oh, Set, it is real. It's happening. It's a thing.
Was that a little Set reference, the Egyptian god of crocodiles?
Yeah.
Oh, very good. Okay.
See what I did
but
there?
Benjamin, yeah, you've seen episodes of Moon Knight. But Ben...
Unfortunately,
you've seen some of Moon Knight, which was rubbish. But Benjamin, that's neither here nor there, because we're talking about Joker Folie à Deux. And I tell you what, Ben, they look like they spend a lot of money on this. But if the Irish taxation system is anything to go by, probably mostly on cigarettes.
It's all cigarettes, Michael. That's all Joaquin Phoenix does in this trailer is smoke cigarettes.
Everyone's banging away at cigarettes. Joaquin Phoenix is smoking cigarettes. Lady Gaga's smoking away at cigarettes. Everyone's just smoking fags the whole time.
Just puffing away, Michael. Don't like that term, as we've covered extensively on this very snippet.
Oh, very good. Yeah, puffing away. He hates it. Hates puffins. One of his least favourite seabirds. Very upsetting.
You know that festival they have in Norway where they help the puffins do their migratory thing? I actually throw them back in.
Yeah, yeah, he stands there intercepting them in a big net and then smashes them all with a rock. But look, yeah. Ben killing seabirds with a rock is neither here nor there because there's other madness going on. Ben, this trailer doesn't show us a lot other than this movie's real and Lady Gaga's in it.
Lady Gaga's very much in it, Michael. She's front and centre. I have a sneaking suspicion, Michael, this is going to be a Lady Gaga starring film.
No, she's definitely starring in it, Ben. I saw the trailer. She was there the whole time.
Yeah, she's right there, front and centre, Michael. There's a lot of vibes going on in this, Michael, that I had a hard time discerning.
All this is vibes.
It's just vibes, man. Just...
What sort of vibes were upsetting you? Tell us what sort of vibes were upsetting you.
Is it a La Land pastiche in places?
It appears to be that there's going to be some sort of, not a musical, some sort of sing-along happening in the shared delusion of these two characters.
Yeah.
And that's what it's going to be about.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, Michael. I don't like that. Because I don't like musicals at the best of times.
I love musicals, Ben. One of my favourites is the musical Cats. But look, this does not tell us if this is a musical or not. And from the trailer, it appears to not be a musical.
I don't know. It's an extended version of the reality we got in the step scene in Joker 1. Because he has his little musical moment in Joker 1.
Everyone's favourite scene, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, arguably, one of the only scenes that people remember from Joker 1 with Joaquin
Phoenix. No, Robert
De
Niro was there, remember?
Oh, yeah. I completely forgot Robert De Niro was in Joker 1.
And Zazie Beetz was there as well, remember? She was in The Next Door Neighbour.
Yeah, but she was only in Arthur's head, Michael.
Oh, was she all imaginary? Are you saying that's what Harley Quinn is? She's all imaginary?
No, I don't think so. I think Harley Quinn is very real in this, Michael. But I think it's interesting. So one of the opening quotes there was, "We use music to make us whole." Michael, if they do another gig of... Look, he's only a badin because he's had a few knocks.
Yeah, and society. It's society's fault.
It's society. I don't know if that's the tact I want to take with the Joker. I don't mind that the Joker is just an unrepentant pain in the hole for Gotham City.
He's just a baddie.
He's just a badden. He's just a badden. That's it.
Benjamin, but look, here's the thing though, right?
Mm.
Does it look like they're going down the road of Dr. Harleen Quinzel being the Joker's psychologist? Because it doesn't look like that to me.
Oh, I don't think so. I think she's a fellow inmate.
It looks like she's a fellow inmate right from the start, doesn't it? Not so. The original origin of Dr. Harleen Quinzel is she is the Joker's psychologist, psychotherapist, physiotherapist.
She's one of the medically certified psychos.
Okay, a physiotherapist. She's the doctor. She's the Joker's physiotherapist, and she's saying, "Just bend your knee there a little bit," and then she falls in love with him and goes equally mad.
Absolutely. She goes a bit mental. Mad in love.
Mad in love in many senses. But in this, it doesn't appear to be that. It just seems like they're two patients? Inmates?
I don't know, Michael. Because there's a scene at the end of this trailer where she's having a chitty chat with him through the glass of a prison conversation. She does a little, she does a little smudgy lipstick move and she's like, "I want to see the real you." And the real him is a psychopath. But we've covered
Benjamin,
that extensively.
We have. Great shot, though.
It's very good.
It's a very clever shot where she puts the lipstick on and then he moves his head and then it goes a little bit out of focus and then he does the big smile. Fantastic shot.
Michael, one of the best things about Joker 1, and it was a limited range with time and hindsight, but visually speaking, very strong film.
Go on.
Joker 1 is a very strong, thematically clear, constructed visual world.
Oh.
There are strong... In looking back at the film, once you understand the narrative that's happening, that Zazie Beetz is in his head and so on and so forth, there are very clear visual cues that on a rewatch allow you to understand what's taking place in Arthur's head and what's taking place in reality, in Gotham's grim society. And we can see very often when his psychosis, and I think it's a fair thing to say psychosis, when his psychosis is peak, it's visually represented by the stronger colours, the bolder colour palette, the game show aesthetic that appears in the Robert De Niro sections. And when reality is contradicting what he chooses to believe, we go back to that grim, gritty, DC bloody movie universe, blue-teal nightmare.
Yeah, horrible stuff altogether.
Yeah.
So whose psychosis is it, though, this? Is it going to be hers or his?
So I would take
or,
us... Go ahead.
Are we going to get a visually distinct one where we get a bit of both and they blend together?
I'm going to hopefully be wrong here, Michael, because we get much more engagement when I'm wrong.
Yeah, people just turn on you.
Turns out that's called Cunningham's Law, Michael.
Named after Liam Cunningham, the Irish actor Liam Cunningham.
Yeah, noted contrarian Liam Cunningham.
Oh, yeah. Good lad.
But anyway, I reckon that Harley Quinn's world is going to be the La Land-esque musical. And then Arthur's world is probably going to feed into that. I'm also not sure, Michael, if this is going to be entirely set in Harley Quinn's psychosis and Arthur is just there, if that makes
sense.
That's
what you were saying earlier when you thought it was going to be her movie.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry, I did not articulate that very well earlier, Michael. But that is what I meant.
That will upset the Joker bros, Ben.
Michael, do you know what? I think a little bit of me thinks maybe that's what they want. Maybe they want to rankle a few bros.
Maybe they want to upset the Joker apple cart.
Yeah, as it were. Such as it is.
That'd be good.
Full of mad apples.
Yeah. Full of absolute mad apples.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't know if we're going to get anything very distinct from the first film. I don't know if it's going to be any good. There's no hint of that in the trailer. It could be. Lady Gaga's very good and stuff. Joaquin Phoenix is very good and stuff.
I thought all indications look like Lady Gaga's doing a great performance. I liked the bit where she pretended to shoot herself. That was a nice bit of I'm slightly madcap acting.
Yes. So there should be an Oscar category for mental illness acting.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it should be given to the person who does the most with whatever mental illness they've been given.
Didn't Ben Stiller have a phrase that he said about that?
Oh, that was... I don't think that... Now, if we're thinking about the same thing, Michael, we also can't say this on the podcast.
Yeah, no, I'm very carefully not saying it.
But it went along the lines of you never go full something.
Yeah.
But I'd say it applies equally here.
Yeah, it's... I wonder if in 25, 30 years we're going to be looking back on movies that featured, I suppose it's already starting, but movies that featured villains who had some sort of mental illness and going, oh, we didn't give them really a good shake, did we?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. We're in that phase now where we're like, that's not a great representation of that stigmatized mental
illness. We've not done a great job of that, have we? We've made that pretty bad, actually, by just making them the baddie. Anyway, Ben, look, sure, we'll probably go and see it, won't we?
We'll have to. We're on a pop culture podcast.
Fucking pop culture podcast. I completely forgot that.
Yeah, it's okay. Easily done, Michael.
Anyway, look, we don't have time to talk about that anymore because I've seen Fallout.
Oh, very good. That's on Amazon Prime, which I just bashed.
Which you bashed about 20 minutes ago. But here's the thing, though, Ben. It's pretty good. It's Fallout. We've talked about it before. We saw the trailers a few weeks ago. It's Fallout. It's not Fallout 3. We kept calling it Fallout 3 for some reason. I don't know why we got muddled.
It's the most popular title in the series, Michael.
I think it might be. But anyway, Benjamin, Amazon Prime has done us a Fallout series. And yeah, it's pretty good, if you ask me. Which I suppose you do, if you're listening to this.
Yeah, so tell us more, Michael. I'll ask you. Was it any good?
It's very good. Yeah, I thought it was very good. The pilot episode, Benjamin, is almost feature length. It's an hour and 20 minutes or so.
That's massive. So it's...
I know, it's massive, isn't it? It's massive. It's great. Because it's got a lot to do. It's got to set up the universe, which I have to say it does fabulously. So it starts in a slightly odd techno-futuristic 50s vibe place. But it's not normal 50s. It's what the 50s thought the future would look like.
Oh, retro-futurism, Michael. Very good.
Kind of, yeah. There's a bit of that going on. And it stars my best friend and yours, Walton Goggins.
I love Walton Goggins.
Everybody loves Walton Goggins. He was even not terrible in Ant-Man and the Wasp. And he's a cowboy, and he's doing lassos at children's parties. And it's a great scene, Ben, where it's this 1950s children's party, and we just keep getting little hints that this children's party is happening on the brink of nuclear war.
Ooh.
And everyone's, no, everybody ignore all that nuclear war stuff. We're having a lovely party for the children.
Classic.
And yeah, it's very good. It's a very good scene. It's one of the best. My jaw was on the floor, Ben. I was aghast watching it.
Oh, Michael, I wish I'd watched this now.
No, it's very good. I highly recommend it. I'm trying to avoid any specific spoilers, but the opening 10 minutes is great bit of television.
Now, Michael, and hold then, on.
Go on.
If there's one thing on this podcast we'll do is we'll saddle up to some spoilers now. Hold on.
You know, I'm gonna hit spoilers first, but I'm going to hit the broad strokes first. Then it follows three characters, Ben, 259 years in the future or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And it's covering the three aspects of the Fallout series. We meet three characters, basically. We meet, I can't remember what the girl's name is, Lucy? Lucy is her name, played by Ella Purnell from out of Yellow Jackets.
Very good.
And she is a nuclear survivor, and she lives in the underground vaults where the people believe that they're keeping the candle of civilization lit.
As it were.
As it were. And it's like any of your standard, we're living underground and there's rationing and things are sad and everyone's fucking their cousins. And But it's good. It's well acted. She's there. Your favourite and mine, Benjamin, Kyle MacLachlan. Famously.
Dune.
Famously. Okay, Dune, yeah. Yeah, I was going to go with Mr. Hyde from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But he's in it. He's the dad. And it's very good. It's a very interesting take. She is very engaging. She plays a kind of, she's a tough, no-nonsense character who's also a bit naive about the world but has skills, and it's not annoying or upsetting, which is fabulous. Then it also follows another character called Maximus, and I forget the actor's name to my ultimate shame, and he is an orphan who's joined the Brotherhood of Steel. And the Brotherhood of Steel live above ground, and they worship the machines and the technology of the pre...
Ah, yeah.
But I tell you what, you don't want to be in the Brotherhood of Steel. It looks awful.
Like, is it like...
It looks like a terrible time.
Does it look like Michael...
Have you found his name
those...
for us, Ben?
Yeah, it looks like... Does it look like... Now, this is an important question for you.
Go on.
Does it look like one of those awful alpha male boot camps that we've seen popping up all over the internet lately?
No, it's much worse than that.
Oh, it's much worse than that.
Yeah, much worse than that. The one I went to was actually pretty good. That's where I discovered I was Mick Prime. Go on.
His name is Aaron Moten or Motten, M-O-T-E-N, I'm not sure.
Very good. He's very good, Benjamin. He does a wounded but maybe sinister guy very well.
I was just going to say it's a classic Walking Dead archetype.
Kind of, yeah, yeah. And the Brotherhood of Steel are very clearly going to be the antagonists or the baddies of this season. But I won't get too much into spoilers. And then the third character we meet is rootin' tootin' gunslingin' lasso wieldin' ghoul, a kind of Fallout zombie man who is hundreds of years old and lives under the ground and has a terrifying legend about him. And he's played by your mate and mine, Walton Goggins.
It's Walton Goggins. Now, Michael, the thing that's upset me the most...
Yes.
But again, given Rule 34 is in fanfickers some joy, is that people are lusting after the ghoul.
Oh, he's a very sexy ghoul, Ben.
People are really into it, Michael. The gang is thirsting for the ghoul, Michael.
Thirsting for Walton, Ben. I think this is Walton Goggins' breakout role, funnily enough. I think he's going to do great. I think he's going to do very good out of this.
Ah, I love Walton Goggins. I love to see it. I'd also like to see a version of Daddy Ghoul. In the style of Daddy Cool, be brought out from the thirsty people who want Walton Goggins.
We'll record that straight away when we finish this podcast, Ben.
Yeah, that sounds fun. Let's do that.
Great. We're both notoriously good singers. One of the good things about it is Ella Purnell, Ben, one of the three leads, she played the games in preparation and takes them very seriously. And there have been some great interviews where some journalists have been quite disrespectful of the whole notion of video games. And she's given them a bit of a little bit snide, a little bit of a... So you played the games, was it all just a big waste of time? Or did it help? And she was like, it's never a waste of time. What's wrong with you? Why are you being such a dick? And fair play to her. People are comparing her to a female Henry Cavill. I don't know, maybe they'll get her in Warhammer as well.
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed, Michael. Come here to me, Come here to me. What? Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like two people to interview celebrities that aren't dicks to them, give us a shout. Try and get us on there.
We might be dicks, though, accidentally, because of the whole... Yeah. Because of the whole poor social skills. But anyway, look, it's good. It's lush. It's very lush. It looks expensive. Mm. They've built real good sets. The underground vaults look like underground vaults. The wasteland looks like a wasteland. It's hard to do a wasteland because it's... You either go super stylistic and say Mad Max Fury Road and it barely resembles the real world anymore. Or else sometimes you're looking at it and going... This is just a desert in America. But then the Fallout series is set in just a desert in America. So that makes sense, actually.
Pretty thematically solid, then.
Yeah, pretty good. But interesting characters, very well acted. I'm no huge Fallout fan, but the Fallout fans that I do know are telling me that it's full of Easter eggs and fun references and is coherent with the lore, if not. It's not telling the story of one of the games, because there isn't one of the games where there are three protagonists and they're all named. And that's not the type of game series this is. This is a show taking place in the world, but people like the world that's been built. And as someone with a, let's say, more than a passing familiarity with Fallout, but not a dedicated super fan, I saw no issues or problems with it. I liked what they did with everything. The iconic Fallout armor, the kind of Space Marine power armor that they have in Fallout, they just went for it. They just did it. As clunky and retro-futuristic and silly as it looks, they committed to it, and the fact that they committed to it works.
That's great.
Yeah, I recommend it. I think it's very good. I watched it with my lovely lady wife, Benjamin, and she found it very stressful and upsetting.
Oh, no.
So that's how you know it's good, because it's supposed to be stressful and upsetting.
Is it because they're trapped underground for so many years, Michael?
Well, no, not really. That's played for laughs, almost.
Oh, okay.
But it is quite violent. There are exploded heads, there are stabbed eyeballs, there is no holding back on the depictions of grossities.
On the gore, you say?
Yeah, exactly. And Walton Goggins has no nose whatsoever.
Very disturbing stuff, Michael. Very disturbing stuff.
Putting my mate and yours, Ralph Fiennes, to shame.
As a ghoul?
Yeah, because remember when he was Voldemort?
Oh, and shame on flat me, nose. Michael. No.
Yeah,
that was a great joke. I dropped the ball.
Benjamin,
I apologize.
Look, you can't blame you because of your political leanings, have been forced to forget everything you've ever known about Harry Potter.
Yes, I'm not allowed to engage with that anymore.
You're not even allowed to say it.
Real piece of work, that JK.
She's doing great work, isn't she? She's really making a lot of fans.
She just never shuts up. You might get some cat ASMR there, ladies and gentlemen, because the cat has just gone under my microphone.
Very good.
So that'll be fun. Yeah,
and that'll get a few extra listens.
Yeah, that should get a few extra listens. I look forward to that.
The big news of the week was X-Men was on.
X-Men was on, Michael, and I have to say, ooh-wee baby. What a time.
Okay, look. I know we were talking about not really spoiling Fallout, because the reason not to spoil Fallout, Ben, is that it's quite a long series and only the most dedicated will have seen all of it by now. Whereas with X-Men 97, if you're listening to this, Ireland's leading X-Men 97 and Michelle Pfeiffer fan cast, and you haven't seen episode 5, get out of here and come back when you've bloody seen it.
Yes, Ireland's leading Michelle Pfeiffer and X-Men fan cast. To me, my Pfeiffers. Yes, very good. Pfeiffers.
Yeah.
Very good.
Anyway,
Michael, last week, you and I said, I don't know if the lads have dropped the ball there with this split episode. I don't know. Still good. And then this week, Michael, they basically slapped us and said, shut your mouth.
They said, shut your mouth and cop a load of this.
Cop a load of this. And Michael, get some of this holy up in fucking you. Shit.
Oh my God, Benjamin. This is the best animated episode of a thing I think I've ever seen. Now, it's hard to say that conclusively because Invincible, the series, has been so good recently too. But
nobody's watching Invincible though.
I think people are watching it, but we should be talking about it more because it was fabulous. And maybe we'll do a retrospective on season 2 because we didn't really keep up with it the way we should have.
We can do an exhumed.
We can do an exhumed on Invincible season 2, exhumed from a few weeks ago. But X-Men 97, episode 5. Oh, flipping hell. Where do we even start, Ben?
Michael, let me give you a little taste of what the... It's horny. It's tragic. It's
back up from your mic there a little bit, Ben. You're starting to blare.
It's horny.
Yeah.
It's got some deep cuts from the lore.
Deep cuts from the lore, Benjamin.
Outrageous fan service, Michael.
Outrageous. Such fan service, Ben.
Michael, this is the X-Men thing that X-Men comic fans have been waiting for. Even if you never watched the animated series back in the day, this is the thing. This is just great.
This, Ben, you haven't even mentioned the step up in animation, the action scenes.
Insane.
Holy moly, was this something else. This was incredible. Ben, big spoilers, obviously. Wild Sentinels, for want of a better term, because that's what they're called in the comics, but they're not called that in this. Wild Sentinels. Lots of stuff happens. Lots of stuff happens in the episode. Cyclops has a big freak out on television.
Yeah, dope.
Good old Scott. Ben, he got tricked. His wife got replaced. He was banging a clone. He had a son. His son was kidnapped by an evil scientist, infected with a virus, and he had to go to the future. The fact he was a little bit upset on television does not make him a dope.
Michael, don't you read our comment section on any one of our social media channels or listen to anyone who has written that Scott Summers is... Don't you be a Scott Summers apologist on this podcast.
This is an anti-Scott Summers podcast.
I fucking...
Anyway, he completely ridiculous. Fucking drops the ball on telly.
He's a fucking donkey.
He's an absolute fucking donkey. Gordon Ramsay was there. He was saying, you fucking donkey, you fucking...
So let's get into spoilers. We're going to have to jump into spoilers from here on out, Michael, and we'll do a blow-by-blow as we go along. The framing of the episode, Michael, is that there's a reporter who's doing an expose on the X-Men to try and humanize them.
And they've done it in 4:3 aspect ratio and put a CRT TV filter over it, which is, chef's kiss. As a fan of 90s media.
Yeah, absolutely. Give me that grain, baby.
Yeah, put it on there.
But come here to me. I was so worried at the start of the episode, and I was like, oh no, if this is just a framing device where secrets get leaked, I'm not into it. Michael, boy, was I wrong.
Oh, you were wrong, Benjamin, because they go to Genosha and they meet all sorts of happy-go-lucky mutants, including famous happy-go-lucky mutant Kurt Wagner. And even more famous happy-go-lucky mutant, Exodus. What's Exodus doing there, Ben, and why is he in a dance scene?
He's just there having a bop with
Exodus
Dazzler.
Does not have a bop.
He does. He's having a little bop.
Is one of the most serious men in the world. He does not have a bop. Why did they have Exodus in a dance scene? At this stage, Ben, it was like, is this like the Planet of the Musicals from the Marvels? Have they just completely screwed the pooch here?
Exodus is ridiculous. He started as a supervillain, and he's a big serious fucker. He really is. He's
the most serious man in the world. Exodus, Paris Dubinois, or whatever his name is.
He got it, that's his name. Paris Bennett, apparently, or Benet du Paris.
Benet du Paris, that's it, yeah. He's the most serious and the least crack man in the world. And for some reason, he's on Genosha and he's finally having a bop. And that's mental. But there's loads of little cameos of favourite X-Men side characters.
Yeah, Glob is there. Robert Herman.
One of the things that worried me, Ben, was I started seeing what I would consider modern X-Men. A.K.A. not Jim Lee 90s X-Men. I saw Glob and I went, that's Glob. He's anachronistic. Then I saw Pixie. I went, what's Pixie doing there? Why is Emma Frost on Genosha? Oh no.
Why is Sebastian Shaw just there? What's going on?
What's happening here? Anyway, before we get into the big event.
Oh, okay, yeah, go on.
No, go on. Go
I will
on,
say as an you, aside, Michael, we got two instances of an Irishman to Genosha.
Yeah,
one of them
Banshee.
Intentional. Yeah, one of them intentional. And one of them wholly racist.
Go on.
We got what is a stage Irishman accent by any other name from whoever was voicing Sean Cassidy or Banshee, who is on the Council of Mutants at Genosha.
I'm on the Council of Mutants.
Yeah. And then we got Moira MacTaggert, Michael. Charles Xavier's ex-wife from Scotland.
She's from Scotland, Benjamin. She sounded a little bit Jamaican, though.
She sounded awfully Jamaican, Michael, and sometimes Irish. I think they got the same man to raise his pitch and just give it a go after they finish with Sean Cassidy. Very interesting.
Just give it a whack. She only has two lines. How bad could it be?
The answer is pretty bad.
Pretty bad.
But you know what, Michael? It kept me so invested because I was like, yes, there's still a ton of jank to this goddamn series. And there's a little bit of me that was wondering, is it intentionally bad to evoke the bizarre spirit of the original series?
I think it might be. I think that might have been what they were doing.
It might be.
Fabulous.
Because what happens next, Michael, is some of the most fabulous mutant storytelling I've ever seen.
Oh, holy God. So Madeline Pryor is having a psychic affair with Cyclops.
Yes.
Yeah. A story which in the comics is more associated with Emma Frost, who was also, funnily enough, in this episode. So I was watching this episode going, oh no, Scott. All three of them are there now. This isn't going to end well for you. But it doesn't end well for anyone.
No, it doesn't well end for a single soul, Michael, as it happens. So I guess it's the A-plot. Genosha is the A-plot, and we were fooled into thinking that the expose was going to be, but that's the B-plot. So the A-plot features Rogue, Gambit, Magneto going to Genosha because the UN is about to accept Genosha as a state.
Sounds great.
And during that time, Magneto is to be their poster boy king, essentially. Mm. And that's what the council's meeting discuss. He does not miss a beat and goes, Rogue, come on, be my queen.
Come on.
And let's fucking do it,
there.
Right? It is fully confirmed within this world that they have been smashing uglies together. They've just been going at it.
Absolutely walloping it. Never mind the fact that he's 60 and she's in her 20s. That's fine in the mutant world.
That's got nothing to do with it. That's got nothing to do with it. But anyway, then we get the most... One of our commentators on TikTok, ladies and gentlemen, go follow us on TikTok, Sure Look, Sure Listen podcast. Actually, while you're doing that, go follow us on Instagram, at Sure Look, Sure Listen podcast. Yep. And also, give us a review wherever you listen, if you're enjoying, to me, my fivers, Ireland's premier podcast for Michelle Pfeiffer fans and X-Men fans. But anyway, we get one of our commenters on TikTok said that this is just a telenovela with superpowers. And I agreed with that commenter. My spirit had gone with them. But this, Michael, confirmed that commenter is spot on the money. Because this, Michael, has the greatest love triangle shock twist in history. Where, first of all, Rogue goes, okay, I'll be queen of the mutants. I'll do that.
Yeah.
She basically turns around to Gambit and says, I love you more than any man I've ever met, but you can't ride me, Gambit, and I can't.
You have to ride me.
That.
And he's like, Sherry, I don't like it.
Rogue and Magneto dance scene.
Benjamin, where is a 60-year-old Holocaust survivor who's dedicated his life to mutant terrorism? Where is he getting the time to learn sexy space dancing?
Michael, it's the horniest. The little kiss, they do a close-up on his face being like, nom, 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 nom. And I was this is awful.
Young ones.
This is awful. So anyway, then Rogue turns around at the end of this after full-on macking with Magneto. She's just,
in front of everyone. In front of everyone, Ben.
In front of everyone. And she goes, ah, do you know what, actually? You are 60 and a bit of a shit kisser. Never mind, I'm going to snog your mate. And she goes off. And she's about to go back to Gambit. And Michael, this is where the literal bombshell of this show hits.
Holy shitballs.
Shitballs, Michael. So as you said, there's a wild Sentinel attack. And Genosha is raised from the earth. Yeah.
Oh, it shocking scenes.
Michael, devastating. I have rarely been so affected by a cartoon, but I genuinely felt for this one. And I was genuinely taken aback. And I think it's because they do such a wonderful job of building up the sense of joy and relief that mutants get to feel in Genosha.
Yeah.
And it's just raised from the earth by this wild Sentinel.
Scenes, Benjamin. It's heavily based on New X-Men by Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely, which I've just realised is a pun on Quite Frankly.
Yes.
I've just realised that now after 24 years. But which is a pun on Quite Frankly. Do you get the pun then?
Yeah, you're spot on. It's, Quite Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Fucking great stuff. I knew it wasn't his real name, but I've just realised now that's a pun. But never mind that, because I don't know if the New X-Men series, E for Extinction is the name of the series. I don't know if that came out before or after September 11th in that America.
It finished in September of 2001. I think it was cancelled directly as a result of 9/11.
Was it? Really?
The event in this, or the event that kind of defined that run, Michael, is the one that's inspired this episode. And that is the absolute, as you said, shit mixing.
Yeah.
Of Genosha.
The shit mixing of Genosha in the comics is actually much worse. 16 million mutants are killed in the comics.
Yeah.
And they are wiped off the map. This has survivors, but what the comic doesn't do is show us. And holy smoly bejolies does this show us.
Yeah. It's funny because I was watching it and I was like, this is so awful to watch. And I would rarely bring real life into anything to do with our podcast, but given the state of the world that we're currently witnessing with all the events in Palestine and stuff.
What do you mean you wouldn't bring the real life? We've been giving Israel shit for months.
I don't know. Fuck Israel. Fuck the state of Israel. Sorry. I just mean we rarely get so serious on the podcast, but there's a clear parallel between what's happening there and what we're witnessing on the news. And it can't have been intentional because this was happening, but it's an eerie parallel and it's very disturbing to watch just with that specter of awfulness hanging over it. It's really bizarre and it's a genuinely affecting episode. And I don't think, I've always loved Magneto, but I don't think I've ever loved Magneto more than in this episode, apart from shifting young ones.
Stop shifting 25-year-olds, Magneto. You're 60. Get a bit of decorum.
But anyway.
Who are you, Andrew Tate?
They're so helpless in the face of this because the Wild Sentinel is a massive kind of merged together series of sentinels.
It's
like a Cthulhu sentinel. I don't know how you describe it. It's just this massive technological horror.
Very spooky and frightening.
Yeah, and Magneto is the one that everybody looks to. And there's a beautiful scene, Michael, where he realizes he's fucked. And he's defending the mutants and he sends Rogue away and he sends Gambit away and out of the blast radius, essentially. He's confirmed to be an Omega-level mutant by the Sentinel.
Which I think is the first time that phrase is uttered in this series.
Yeah, yeah. And that's big. That's important because an Omega-level mutant is a big boss mutant, essentially. Yeah. It's a real fucking threat. And it's interesting because in the 2001 E for Extinction run, it introduced the concept of secondary mutations into the X-Men lore. And that was where basically there was a splinter group of powers that mutants could access in if they evolved to a certain level or if they underwent stress. Classic kind of...
You could get more mutant.
Yeah, you could get more mutant, essentially. But yeah. Anyway, it's the first time it's uttered. But he does turn around and there's a beautiful continuity to it because the person he defends is Leech because Leech is looking for him. And he told Leech in a previous episode that he would never have to be scared again. And then he says in German to Leech, he says, "Habe keine Angst," which is don't be afraid. Mm. And then he just gets vaporized. And it's so not touching quite to Magneto's story because he is a Holocaust survivor and he reverts to German in that moment of great fear. Michael, I had to stop. I had to sit back and just be like, holy fuck.
Then, Benjamin, we get one of the most heroic sacrifices in all of children's animation.
Oh, fucking hell, man. One of the fabulous things about this episode, again, you spoke a little bit there about how the animation is really on another level here. Get the double team of Rogue and Gambit using their powers in full swing, and it's a joy to watch. Watching Gambit let loose and kinetically charge things and fling them about. And there's a fabulous sense of confidence from Gambit in how much he trusts Rogue. Because he watches Rogue tussle with a Sentinel one-on-one. And he knows for a fact she's going to be fine. So he just keeps going. And it's magic. And then, Michael.
Yeah.
Just.
Gets stabbed.
Yeah. Just as we're sucking oxygen back into our lungs post-Magneto, he gets stabbed. He gets run through by a tendril, essentially.
Yeah.
And he charges up his whole body and kinetically blows this thing to kingdom come.
Yeah. Incredible scenes.
Incredible. And, oh man, even the last line from Rogue that ends the episode, I can't feel you.
Oh, very sad, very upsetting.
It's so tragic because the only way she can touch him without absorbing him is if he's dead.
And she just picked him.
And she just picked him. And he never knew. She never got a chance to say that. Only Eric knew.
Awful stuff altogether. Now, Benjamin, there's an outside chance because we saw Cable and Cable was doing a Groundhog Day moment.
Yeah.
I was too late again. There's an outside chance that this all gets undone in the next episode. But to my mind, that almost doesn't matter.
It doesn't. This was peak storytelling. All criticisms of voice acting, anything like that, gone out the window. Everything in that episode was delivered with aplomb. It was just...
Bring Bo DeMeo back. We don't care what he did. Unless it turns out that what he did was awful.
But this is the interesting thing, because all I could think... There's a scene, Michael, where Bo DeMeo is in the episode. He's one of the mutants that gets first.
Yeah, he's just chilling out in the background getting vaporized.
And one of the interesting things here is, Michael, it must have been awful what he did, because what he has delivered is fabulous.
Yeah, look, maybe it's a James Gunn situation where it gets resolved and they bring him back and they apologize. Who knows, but... I don't know. Look, it's great. This is great. Last week's episode was a little bit of a low point, but this is one of the best. We haven't even got into the psychic affair with Madeline. That was amazing. We haven't got into, like, all the cameos and... Oh, just fucking... Oh, great stuff.
Insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
Speaking of great stuff, though, Ben.
Oh.
We had a suggestion from my good friend and your arch nemesis, Shane, regular contributor to the podcast, and he said we should do an Exhumed episode on the 1985.
Shane's fault?
Yeah. We should do an Exhumed episode on the 1985 fantasy classic, Richard Donner's Lady Hawk.
Yes, so we did that.
How did you feel about that? Yeah, we did that, didn't we?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, Ben. The 1985 Richard Donner classic fantasy romance film, Lady Hawk. First of all, almost lost media. Very hard to watch anywhere.
I would put this in the category of better off lost media.
Oh, you've spoiled it, Ben, because that's what I was going to do next. It's hard to find it. We had to watch it on my DVD copy.
Yes, your DVD copy that you rented from Tala Library.
I never gave back. So you had to come up to my house and we watched it together. And I tell you what, Ben, it doesn't hold up.
No, Michael, this is...
It's not very good.
I turned to you in the midst of this, Michael, and I said, yeah, Lady Hawk might be the worst thing we've ever watched for Exhumed.
I don't know if it is. We've watched stuff that is categorically worse in that this isn't appalling. It's just long and a little bit boring. And a lot of the same scenarios happen over and over again. And you're going... This could have been half an hour, or this could have been an 80s fantasy series if you wanted. So anyway, Ben, the film opens on Matthew Broderick escaping from justice in Europe, not for the first time, as Mouse. Ben, I mulled over that joke for the whole weekend and I was thinking, will I do that? Or he was in that car accident nearly 40 years ago.
Accident,
Yeah, has he paid his dues? And then I found out he paid a £100 fine for reckless driving, and that was all. I'm going to leave it in.
Oh, Matthew Broderick's a cunt. Yeah. No, I'm
right.
Not.
Okay.
No,
right. You've taken a less, maybe, humanistic view of it than I have there.
I have no time for Matthew Broderick.
Okay, very good. I hope you have plenty of time for him, because he's in this film in nearly every scene.
Yes, Gaston the Mouse.
He's a thief who escapes a prison in, like, medieval Italy. And everything's realistic.
Is it Italy or France?
It's Italy, I think.
No, because it's Gaston and Navarre and Isbo. Yeah. So it's French, I think. Isbo.
Is it French? Okay. I think it was filmed in Italy.
I think it's French. And I think it's quite important when we look at how they've named the characters... And the semi-fantasy Christian-inspired lore of it. Because The weird thing about 1985's Lady Hawk is that it is incredibly fueled by French medieval texts.
Go on.
There's a whole genre in medieval manuscripts from France, Michael, of animal parables.
Oh.
Where it follows the exploits of various animals as they go through. They are essentially human animals. But the major character that would have come out of that was the rooster, Michael. Oddly enough, if you've ever watched Disney's Robin Hood, that rooster is a play on a famous French medieval character called the Chanticleer.
Okay.
And Chanticleer is just the French for... he's called... You're going to have to forgive me this. Chanticleer the cock.
It's the French word for cock, Ben. It's also the English word.
Yeah.
I don't know why you're apologizing.
The interesting thing about this, Michael, is Chanticleer the Cock and Reynard the Fox are two famous figures within that. Chanticleer the Cock is associated with music and bard kind of tales and things like that. And Reynard is, as any fox would be, associated with trickery and mischief. And they were two animals within medieval French texts that could take the form of humans. And there's a bizarre true line of that running throughout this fucking film. And all I could think was, every time I watched this, I think you're trying to do something with this. I really think you are pushing to give this a go. And then they just kept falling short because they do really weird anachronistic things. Stick a heavy Miami Vice bass track.
Oh, okay, look, we can't not talk about the soundtrack. The soundtrack is one of the most out-of-place soundtracks in all of cinema history. The opening scene is like... Yeah, they might as well put the Knight Rider theme on the opening scene of this movie. It's insanely bad, the soundtrack of this film. I think that this film... And I would be very surprised if no one has ever attempted. This film could be entirely rescored, and it would make it... a couple of notches a better movie.
Yes. Yes.
Because there are moments when a stirring, heroic orchestral piece would do wonders for the tone of this. Or maybe a bit of lute music as they're approaching a comedy scene or something like that. Bang some Lord of the Rings music in this and you take this up a notch. But put in some 80s fucking workout video synth pop inexplicably in romantic scenes.
It's inexplicable.
You could call it a bold choice, but it's not. It's just a bad choice.
Yeah, I think we often try to, when someone has a swing and a miss, Michael, sometimes it's an accidental miss. Sometimes they miss the ball and it sails clean past. In this case, a swing and a miss came about when people were playing handball and it just wasn't appropriate. It's fucking bizarre.
Weird,
Michael.
Weird, absolutely mad choice on the soundtrack. Terrible soundtrack. Some of the music isn't bad music, but
no.
Just incredibly wrong music for this movie. Even some rock. Okay, go 80s, go hair metal.
Anything except what we got.
Oh, it's incredible, Benjamin. This is a story of the captain of the guard, Navarre, and his lover, Isabeau. Now, Ben, when we were watching this together, I pointed out to you that Rutger Hauer was 41 when this was made and Michelle Pfeiffer was 27, and you said, perfect, ideal.
Magneto and Rogue, eat your heart.
No, Ben, no, that's there. Isabeau is older than Rogue and Rutger Hauer is 2 decades younger than Magneto. It's borderline iffy, but not Rogue Magneto iffy.
No, it's definitely not that. It's... Oh, Michael, this was so weird. Because I was doing some digging on this. And Rutger Hauer is a weird choice for a leading man. I don't care what anyone says. Rutger Hauer... And this was Rutger Hauer's last attempt at leading man. He said he really didn't enjoy the experience of playing the leading man.
Benjamin, he was 41 when he made this. I'm 41. I don't enjoy anything.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. Yeah, that's very fair, Michael. But he turned away from that. But it was never supposed to be him. We were supposed to get none other Oh, no.
Kurt Russell.
Thank you. I got the wrong Russell. I was about to say Russell Crowe. It was supposed to be Kurt Russell.
Who was a child at the time.
Who was Navarre. It was supposed to be Kurt Russell. And that, Michael, all I can think now is how much better Kurt Russell would have suited the soundtrack of this movie.
Yeah, maybe they wrote the soundtrack when they thought it was going to be Kurt Russell. I don't see Kurt Russell doing a performance in the world that saves this. That makes it any better.
No, it can't be. Yeah, look, it's an interesting film. So the central premise is there is the Prison of Aquile. That's what it's called. And the Prison of Aquile houses lots of terrible people, but it's run by a horny, lusty old bishop.
Great performance from the bishop. Yeah. Feckin' great villain. Almost shades of, even though it was before, shades of Alan Rickman as the Count of Monte Cristo. Who am I thinking of? The Sherlock Holmes. Fuck, we've been recording for so long. Who's the fella? The Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah, Alan Rickman is the Sheriff of Nottingham. I thought it was Alan Rickman for a second and I got very excited. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's not Alan Rickman.
But it's a good performance. I like him in it.
He did strike me, Michael, as the love child of Michael Palin and Eric Idle from Monty Python. But I liked the cut of his jib. I have no doubt, Michael, that years later, there was a Disney animator who watched this and said, oh, we should do a Hunchback of Notre Dame adaptation and just do the same plot. It'd be great. Yeah,
a bishop because, in there.
Yeah, there's a real lusty bishop motif going on here. And he's the worst. Because he's just a greedy, avaricious old lech.
Yeah.
And it makes him awful.
He puts a magic curse on Michelle Pfeiffer, which I think is rude, first of all.
Rude.
That's Michelle Pfeiffer, and we're the world's leading Michelle Pfeiffer fan cast. And he puts a curse on Michelle Pfeiffer and Rutger Hauer so that she's a hawk by day and he's a wolf by night, and they get the briefest of moments when they can nearly touch during the sunset. And I don't think that's enough of a concept to support a two-hour film.
But, Michael, here's the thing, right? That one little smidgen of writing...
It's the only supernaturally that happens in this whole film.
It's bizarre. But there are moments of beautiful, poetic punishment and justice that appear throughout this thing. In a fairy tale. There's a beautiful Rutger Hauer's character of Navarre says, always together, never understanding that we are. So like when he's a wolf, he doesn't remember his time with Isabeau. When she's a hawk, she doesn't remember her time with Navarre. And there is a beautiful, awful terribleness to that. And it makes that bishop a real piece of shit. And there's a few other moments where there's a great twist and there's glimmers of good setup and delivery. So one of my favourite bits in this, Michael, Alfred Molina turns up about 3/4 of the way into the film.
10 minutes from the end.
And he's the wolf catcher. And he's been given basically the method to catch the great black wolf. But Michael, in a moment of absolute... I would say spoilers, but this movie's so shit I don't recommend you go watch it. In a moment of absolute poetic justice, he falls into one of his own wolf traps and he dies horribly.
Very painful.
And you see it all. It's bizarre.
Yeah. In a relatively bloodless film as well. It's just, oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. Do not give me a close up of that man's face as he's trapped in a wolf trap. Stop
yeah,
it. Stop that.
That looks very sore.
But there are other bizarre tonal moments here, Michael. For example, at one point I was certain that Rutger Hauer was about to be cooked by Matthew fucking Broderick.
Yeah. He might.
Because the chemistry between Michelle Pfeiffer and Matthew Broderick, while not a lot, is still better than the chemistry between Rutger Hauer.
Well, they're not on screen, Benjamin, because they're cursed to never be together.
But it's bizarre. And it's very clear that the Gaston the Mouse is, I would fuck Isbo. I would. Yeah. I would.
If I had the chance. Not trustworthy.
If that wolf turned around for 2 minutes, that's all I'd need.
But I think that's on purpose as well, because it just... Yeah. They cast Michelle Pfeiffer, which is a great idea, but they also wanted to basically make it every man falls in love with her.
But
they had
again,
to do that to justify the whole plot.
That's a classic medieval tale trope where two knights fall for the same woman and each one tries to outdo the other to win the woman over, and only the woman will choose in the end. It's Shakespeare in itself. Do you know what I mean? It's a classic love triangle thing. But, like, how bizarre is it that this movie occasionally pulls off that kind of thing and yet is still so awful?
I don't know if it's awful. It's just slow. There's so many scenes of one of the animals is in trouble.
Yeah.
And let's rescue them. And let's, while we're rescuing them, pretend that we don't know it's Michelle Pfeiffer. It overstays its welcome in the middle part by a good chunk. It probably could have done with one major thing happening instead of a series of minor things.
There is no great major thing, really.
No. They stumble through a series of small misadventures, eventually meeting the monk who accidentally, or well, on purpose, revealed their love and caused the whole thing. And that kind of gets the plot moving a bit. But, like, we're treated, and I'm doing this in air quotes, to nearly 20 minutes of Matthew Broderick dicking about before the film even really starts.
I don't know who saw the film War Games and went, that young man reminds me of Buster Keaton, and said he'd be great in a physical comedy role, because he's not. He's doing his best, but he's got no timing. So he does these kinds of exaggerated physical comedy moments that don't come off because Matthew Broderick apparently is not a gifted physical comedian.
I like how they took Matthew Broderick's tendency towards asides to the camera and had him do it to God, which I thought was a nice little twist.
But this is the interesting thing. So this is pre-Ferris Bueller. And I can only imagine, given the anachronistic portrayal by Matthew Broderick, because he's not in the same movie as everyone else, not even a little bit. Like, he's in a completely separate movie thematically, to the point that at the end, when he is forced into the film, and I'll get into it in a second, he is forced to participate in the bizarre tone of the film. It's so jarring, and I'll get into that in 2 seconds. He plays the smug Ferris Bueller character, and I guarantee you someone saw that and went, this kid's good at being a smug dick. And then they made him Ferris Bueller. Now, I like Ferris Bueller, but he is a smug dick. And that it's interesting. Cool. I think that's a great observation from you, that he gives his side to God instead of...
Yeah, God. Yeah, because it's the 80s, so people have to be constantly quipping and talking.
If it was a realistic film, it gets him killed constantly. He pickpockets a guard in the lake and he goes, I know, Lord, I swore I wouldn't do it, Lord, but I won't do it again. But he says that out loud.
You know I'm a weak man, Lord.
But he says that while the guard is 2 meters from him. And then another time he starts...
stage acting. He's doing a bit of stage acting. The guards can't hear him. Only God and the audience can hear him.
But another time, Michael's stabbing someone in the foot in a very well-lit grate. And he's, get off my fingers. He's making all these weird John Mulaney quips.
Yeah, it's gas. It's not great. It's long. There's elements to the romance aspect of it that are quite poetic and quite interesting. And it definitely has a story to tell. But it could have told that story in 80 minutes instead of over 2 hours.
Any other way.
And seriously, sort out that soundtrack.
Yeah, soundtrack is pretty rough. Ladies and gentlemen, we could go on about this all day, but we just don't have time. Ladies and gentlemen, if you hated Lady Hawk as much as us, please get in touch with us and let us know. There are a few places you can do that. You can find us on the interwebs.
I just didn't like it, but I didn't hate it.
www.seomrabeag.com, SEOMRABEAG.com.
It means Tiny Roman Irish to some degree.
You can also find us on our other website for some reason, www.yourluxurelistenpodcast.acast.com.
It's more up to date because it's automatic.
Because it's automatic and we have to do less things. You can find us on Instagram, where we make little reels. We're more bearable in 1 minute segments, as it turns out. You can find
Not
us on Instagram.
To my mother, Ben. My mother hates them.
What?
Tell
Pamela. That's devastating news from Pamela. I won't lie.
Devastating news. My mother's name's not Pamela.
It is, according to this podcast. If you listen back a few episodes, I christened your mother Pamela for the purposes of these conceits.
Exactly.
Come here to me. You can find us at Your Luxury Listen Podcast. You can find us on TikTok at Your Luxury Listen.
Oh, big news up there.
But the best way to get in touch with us, ladies and gentlemen, is to hop up on the Discord linked below in the description.
Oh, yeah. Hop up on it.
Get up there and give it a go. Ladies and gentlemen, you can join us in a week's time where we're going to be answering the age-old question, at least since the late 80s. These vampires are too damn sexy. Why?
Why are vampires so sexy? What's going on with them?
Why are they so bloody sexy? There's going to be some Anne Rice. There's going to be some Castlevania. There's going to be some classic Victorian Irish literature. Forget about
great
it.
Great stuff.
Unlike sorry, this was so long. Lady Hawk. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, this was so long. See you next week.
Bye.
That's going to be...